From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Chicago, 1947. A man named Clyde Ross moved from Mississippi in an effort to escape the abusive inequality that targeted African Americans like himself. Clyde had served in World War II, but as the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates explains in a piece for The Atlantic, Clyde battled tyranny abroad only to come home and find more tyranny here. So he moved to Chicago, took a job with Campbell Soup, made decent money, got married, and then, at long last, he bought a home. Or so he thought. As Coates tells it, Ross was making payments not to the bank as with a normal mortgage, but directly to the seller. He had purchased the house on contract, which was a predatory agreement in which thousands of families of color were swindled. Here's how Coates described the details of Clyde Ross's 1947 mortgage. Quote, Ross had bought his house for $27,500. The seller, not the previous homeowner, but a new kind of middleman, had bought it for only $12,000 6 months before selling it to Ross. In a contract sale, the seller kept the deed until the contract was paid in full, and unlike with a normal mortgage, Ross would acquire no equity in the meantime. If he missed a single payment, he would immediately forfeit his $1,000 down payment, all his monthly payments, and the property itself. End quote. Maybe you wonder, why didn't Clyde Ross try to get a traditional mortgage? He did. Loan officers told him there was no financing available. That was a lie that black families would hear repeatedly. This is just part of the history of redlining and housing discrimination in our country, but I have a confession to make. I was nearly 30 years old before I even heard the term redlining. It was not taught in my schools, and I've wondered why it's not taught in many schools in New York State. Recently, I got an email from a local suburban teacher who explained that he does, in fact, choose to teach it and related subjects, and I immediately wanted to know. Why isn't it part of the standards? How do students respond to the lessons? How do administrators feel about it? So we're going to start there with a lot of ground to cover, and I'm really glad to have Shane Wiegand here. He's a fourth grade teacher at File Elementary in the Rush Henrietta School District. Shane, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on, Evan.
You reached out to let me know what you do, but not to sort of pat yourself on the back, but just to make sure that I was aware that it is taught in certain ways, but you also wanted to kind of tie it to some things going on in the community now. We're going to get there, but if we could, I want to learn more about what you're doing first. So,
sure.
So you grew up in the Rochester area. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Homestead Heights near Bay in the city. And when I was four, we moved to Webster for the schools, and my dad worked at Xerox, and we wanted to be closer to good schools and to Xerox.
Okay. And do you remember how old you were the first time you heard the term redlining?
Probably in my 20s.
In your 20s. Certainly not in school growing up.
Oh, never in school.
Yeah. Okay. And me neither, right. And I think a lot of people. In fact, I reached out to Twitter, Facebook, and a number of places just to let people know. I'd love to know from you, when's the first time you heard the term? Here's a quick sampling. Christine writes, didn't hear about it until I was an adult. Megan Charlin writes, 31 years old, right now. I just had to Google the term redlining. There's an example. Rain writes, probably 18 or 19. I was an American history major. Pat writes, 27, I'm guessing. Trish writes, I went to public New York City schools, K through 8, and then a Catholic New York City high school. We never learned about redlining. Peter says, I was 60 when I first heard the term. Kevin and Christopher write to me, say they've never heard that term before, redlining. So it's certainly not taught regularly, right?
Oh,
fair to say, right?
Yeah.
And you became a teacher. How long you been a teacher?
This is my sixth year teaching.
Sixth year teaching.
Yeah.
You enjoy it?
I love it.
And you teach fourth grade.
Fourth grade is the best.
You got a big smile on your face. So obviously you've got an affinity for your job. But when did you start to think about teaching, redlining, mortgage fraud, housing discrimination, that kind of stuff?
I went to SUNY Geneseo, and I got my master's there as well in childhood multicultural education, which approaches education from a more critical perspective. It's called critical pedagogy. And one of the things that they talk about a lot is helping kids read the world and to put their culture and where they live in context and to make reading, learning, social studies real to them. So when we talk about civil rights, to me it makes sense that let's not just talk about Martin Luther King. Let's talk about when he came here, when Malcolm X came to Rochester. Let's talk about segregation in Rochester. And then as I started looking into those kinds of things, I realized, oh, wow, Rochester's still really, really segregated, and it's that way on purpose. And I discovered this term redlining through Ta-Nehisi Coates' article and through a bunch of other articles.
And so when Shane reached out to me recently, it was right after we wrapped up our 5 report series on teacher diversity. And if you missed any of those reports, you can find them on the WXXI News website. Click on the Degrees of Diversity tab there. We've got maps that will show you your school district's diversity numbers for both students and staff and our series of reports. And Shane just reached out because I had used the term self-segregation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for you, that kind of stood out in your mind. Why?
Well, because I think for white people, like my parents, they had the choice to self-segregate to Webster for a whole variety of reasons. Whereas I think there are many people of color in Rochester that have systematically been denied that choice and still don't have that choice because of this history that stems from redlining and disinvestment.
And so if you were a high school teacher, you would teach redlining, you would teach housing discrimination differently than you do to fourth graders, fair to say?
Oh, definitely.
Of course. And I think some listeners may be surprised to hear, wow, the teacher you have on is a fourth grade teacher and you're teaching this subject now. So I'm curious to know, first of all, how you approach the subject with fourth graders to begin with.
Well, I slow it down a little bit, and it starts really naturally in one of the read-aloud books, a really popular Newbery Award-winning book called Maniac McGee by Jerry Spinelli. And in that book, there's two sides of town. There's a black side of town and a predominantly white side of town. And as I'm reading this to the kids, almost every year I've read it to my fourth graders as a read-aloud, someone says, that's kind of similar to where we live, because a lot of the kids in Henrietta have moved to Henrietta from the city. And so they're aware of this already. And naturally, the question is, well, why does this happen? You know, why is our community like this? And so I'll pull up the New York Times mapping inequality map that they published last year, and I'll show the kids the Rochester region. And you can see its little blue dots stand for where African Americans live and green dots stand for where white people live. And in the map, it forms almost like a crescent shape on the map. You can see it. And the kids are like, why are all the black people living in this neighborhood, or why are so many living in this neighborhood?
Sure. And so the kids are asking questions naturally.
Exactly.
And how do you start to answer that? Is that the natural lead-in to the lessons then?
Exactly. That's the natural lead-in. And then from there, I do a little bit of talking about, I show them the red line map. And we put the two maps next to each other and we talk about the similar shape. And that where these areas, where the redlining was, is where many African Americans live. And I don't go into the in-depth details of everything that the Homeowners Loan Corporation did or about the Federal Housing Authority, but I give some basics about what a mortgage is and what that means and how you get a mortgage and how you buy a house. And we talk a lot about where do you want to live, you know, and who do you want to live by and what makes a good neighborhood a good neighborhood. And the kids have all kinds of thoughts about that. And then we talk about, well, a lot of people in our community didn't really have a choice in where they live. And most people were told, you need to live here in the third ward or over here off of Joseph. And I think that the kids, they're really fascinated to learn about that.
Yeah, I open the program with that story that Ta-Nehisi Coates tells in his piece. The piece, by the way, comes from 2014 in The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations. I know the word reparations is a volatile one to many Americans. I would just urge you to read that entire piece before, you know, sort of making any judgments, because what Coates is making a case for is just understanding the discrimination and the economic theft, really, mm-hmm. That families of color experience. And so Clyde Ross's story was just one of so many. And I wonder, first of all, you know, when you're working with fourth graders, mm-hmm. and you're working with fourth graders, white students, students of color,
yeah.
students of different backgrounds, are they upset to hear this? Are they, you know, is there any sort of emotional reaction? How would you describe their reaction to this?
I think it's still a little bit abstract for them when they hear it. They're not necessarily upset. Some of the kids feel angry or confused, and they want to know more. And so one of the things I do with the kids is I read them a couple stories about people to make it more personal for them, and to kids respond in fourth grade to stories. And so we read some interviews that a professor at U of R, who's now at Bloomfield in New Jersey, Dr. Laura Warren Hill, she did a bunch of interviews with local civil rights activists like Dr. Walter Cooper and Clarence Ingram and Loma Allen. And I read some of those interviews where they're just kind of telling their story of trying to buy a house in Rochester. And they get pretty angry when I read to them about how Walter Cooper, he tried something like 50 or 60 different apartments and houses that he tried. He and his wife, someone who was a postdoc at the U of R, couldn't get an apartment in the city of Rochester or a house. And it makes the kids angry for sure.
Yeah, we've talked to Ruth Scott and so many others who, those stories, the Clyde Ruff stories from 1947, that was happening in Rochester in 1947. Yep. It also happened in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s. And it is our history. And when you look at what happens to people like Clyde Ruff, well, his boiler blows. He's owned the house for 3 months. His boiler blows. And if he can't afford to fix it, or if something happens, all of a sudden you could be in a crisis because you're not building equity and you're in this fraudulent agreement with a middleman and you lose your property. And then where do you go? Well, in Chicago, where in many places, those families were pushed into certain places. And that's how those communities, the slur ghetto in other terms, was created. It was created by largely white people who abused families, who simply wanted to escape discrimination, and that's how these communities were created. And now I think here's the challenge and the problem. One of the problems, I think, Shane, and I'm curious to get your take on this. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, and maybe today, maybe this hour, we'll have callers. Callers, I want to hear from you on this in a lot of different ways. Number one, what do you think about what you're hearing? Number two, should this be taught in schools, and when? I mean, you're hearing from a fourth grade teacher. How about high school? How about middle school? Number three, were you taught this growing up? When's the first time you heard the term redlining? 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. There's no shame in any of this. I mean, I was almost 30 the first time I heard it. Shane said, you were in your 20s probably? Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's no shame in this. I mean, it's not really taught very much. But we're going to hear from people, as we always do, and I understand why, who say it's the wrong message to tell people today that you're not in control of your own destiny, you're not in control of your own circumstances, that you can rise above it. We need to send this message. You can rise above it. You can rise above it. And we see these great success stories where people do that. But I think at the same time, if we just sort of pretend that, well, your circumstances are your own fault, as opposed to owning part of the history, you get that push-pull, I think, of trying to understand what led to these circumstances and how do we deal with that while also hoping not to extinguish the desire for everyone to better their own lives. You know what I mean? And so, have you heard from any parents who don't like that you're teaching this subject?
No, I haven't heard anything from parents about it.
You haven't?
No.
Okay. Administrators?
Nope, I haven't had any feedback either way about it. We're given a lot of freedom to interpret the standards how we want to interpret them and teach them, and part of the Common Core is to be investigative and to learn how to find evidence and from a variety of sources. And so it also encourages us to do things that are in the context of the kids' lives. And this is something that is about our community, and so it naturally fits. But I haven't had a lot of feedback. Okay. But it's not something I've broadcasted necessarily easy either.
No, of course, absolutely. And so, Mr. Wiegand, let's play a little scenario. Let's say someone who has interacted with my show regularly may be a parent of a student who ends up in your class and sends you a note that says, hey, respect what you're doing, but I think you're sending the wrong message, and students have to know that no matter what led to 2016, 2017, that today everyone has an equal opportunity, and I want them to know that, and you're teaching them that, that they are not in control of their own destiny, and that is not something that I want taught. What would you say to a parent like that?
I think I would respond respectfully and say that I disagree, and that, in fact, I think that in teaching this, I'm really empowering the kids in my classroom, one, to learn how to think critically, and two, to look for root causes for today's problems. Problems come from somewhere, and in class, whether it's math, social studies, or science, we're always talking about solving problems. So if we're talking about solving a problem in our community, I want to give the kids the tools and some of the background and some of the learning the ways to how to think about these kinds of problems to solve those problems, which to me, I think is empowering.
Couldn't agree more about that. I think that's absolutely right. And then so I'm curious to know what your colleagues think. So you're a fourth grade teacher. Mm-hmm. I don't know of other teachers teaching this. I've heard from some listeners this morning, white, black, Latino, who tell me, in their own lives, the term didn't come up until a little bit later and had to learn a little bit more. So I'm not sure this is taught in very many places at all. Why isn't it part of the standards? Why is this not taught more regularly?
I don't know. It's kind of like a question like, why isn't Columbus taught? The bad things that Columbus did that we've all...
The reality of Columbus.
The reality of Columbus. Not the myth. I mean, I think we teach... I don't think our textbooks are... maybe partially intentionally stilted towards telling a story of American exceptionalism, or at least having pride in our country. And in doing that, I think sometimes some of the grittier and dirtier and more uncomfortable details are often left out. And I think we all naturally want to tell a positive story about ourselves and a more positive story about our history that's more triumphal. And in fact, I think we owe it to our kids to tell them the truth so that they can be a part of solving these problems and admitting them.
Do you think then, with your efforts as a fourth grade teacher to at least plant the seed of knowledge, you can't give them all of the depth of, you know, mortgage fraud and housing discrimination and everything that went into that. But you can give them that base knowledge that allows them to ask questions, but does it need to be built upon by their subsequent teachers? In other words, are you talking to fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth grade teachers and teachers in high school in your district to say, hey, you know, or are you thinking, well, this is my job, I'm going to put my head down and do this here, and they'll do what they do?
I think I've slowly started to share it with some of my colleagues in fifth grade and other fourth grade teachers. Only a little bit. I don't want to push it on anybody, but I also want there to be more awareness. And each year of teaching, as I grow in my confidence and feel like I'm doing a better job teaching these kinds of things, I'm more and more willing to kind of spread it around and talk about it. And that's part of why I wanted to come on the show, is because I really think it needs to be taught. Just like we teach Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement almost every year in social studies in elementary and high school. And I just wonder, so why do we leave out our local civil rights struggle? Why didn't I learn about FIGHT? I never learned about the Rochester riots growing up in Webster. I never learned about housing discrimination in Webster. And the question was never even asked, is Rochester still a segregated place today? And if so, like, is the civil rights movement over?
So I will be taking some of your calls. I see the phone starting to ring. But before we jump into that, you know, you mentioned FIGHT, and you also brought up, I think, Worth v. Selden. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So just a little bit of that history. Can you kind of give us a little background for people who are not familiar?
One of the biggest problems in Rochester was housing, and in all these northern cities. And Lyndon B. Johnson commissioned a report called the Kerner Report to investigate why were so many rebellions and uprisings and riots happening in northern cities like Rochester. And the response that the Kerner Commission wrote was that it has largely in part due to housing and poor housing connected to discrimination. And so in Rochester, FIGHT was pushing back against that, and Metro Act, a local group that originally was friends of FIGHT, they filed a suit that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they lost in a 5-4 decision in 1973, where they went against the town of Penfield Zoning Board. A man named Robert Worth was trying to buy a house in Penfield, but because of the discriminatory zoning laws that were the effects of the Fair Housing Act of 68 not being enforced, he couldn't buy a house there, as did many other black people weren't able to buy houses there and in other suburban towns.
And if you were teaching this, you know, again, for students at a higher grade level then, would you kind of delve into this history a little bit more granularly, a little more in detail?
Definitely. With my fourth graders, the main thing I say about this case, which I do want to bring up, is I want the kids to know that people of color and people who are white, they worked together and fought against this form of discrimination. And again, that comes back to the empowerment. I'm teaching the kids, like, what do you do in the face of oppression? What do you do when you're bullied or discriminated against? And they're really receptive to that. You form a group. You don't do it alone. You work together. And I really want to teach that history to my kids.
Shane Wiegand is a fourth grade teacher at File Elementary School in the Rush Henrietta School District, and he's talking to us about his lessons for his students and why he chooses to teach redlining as just part of, would you call it a unit, or is it, you know, sort of a, you know, redlining is part of what, you know, framework would you describe?
It's part of our social studies unit that has to do with the Great Migration and of African Americans.
Okay. Yeah. And before I take our first phone call, one more point to stress here is the fact that you feel empowered to make this decision to teach this. Mm-hmm. That there's a lot of debate or discussion about whether teachers, number one, have any time to be either creative or make decisions on what material to include because of standardized testing and things like that. And there's a lot of concern that teachers don't have a lot of wiggle room because of those things. And then there's also concern that, you know, do you have the academic freedom? And it sounds like you feel like you have a lot of room there.
Yeah, I definitely do. I have a great principal and a great district that I work in that are definitely, they're very trusting in teachers and our ability to, you know, plan our curriculum and based off of the standards and the maps that they give us, but to also go where that we think the kids need to go.
All right, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free. Call the program and let us know your thoughts on this subject and when you first encountered redlining and housing discrimination, and or if you did in school. I didn't. I mean, that's not something I was taught growing up. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Stefan in Rochester is first up on the phones. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for bringing this topic to the program. I teach, I've taught for over 20 years high school history in Rochester, New York, in the city. And under a Teaching American History grant, a federal professional development grant, my partner, Steve LaMorte, and I presented a year-long program for teachers on the long civil rights movement. I think there's pretty wide understanding of redlining and other housing discrimination and institutional racism inside our system in the higher ed history folks community, but it doesn't always get to the high school teachers in a way that they could feel confident enough to teach it within the context of a region's curriculum, for example. So what we did was we brought college professors to present to high school teachers and then provided resources and opportunities to develop lessons around topics like redlining and other civil rights topics as part of a year-long civil rights history professional learning program. But that was funded by a federal professional development grant and would have been impossible to put together without it. So creating opportunities for people in higher ed to both provide high school teachers with the knowledge and resources to bring this to kids and to find ways to tuck it into a very overstuffed high school curriculum. Your guest has the opportunity, some flexibility, because he's teaching fourth grade, that some of our high school colleagues don't always have because of the kind of overstuffed curriculum that we have to cover. Mm-hmm. So we have to find ways to kind of insert it. Shane said that he uses the Great Migration. I did that in my classroom, and I also reintroduced it when we were looking at civil rights activism and looking for local examples of civil rights activity around issues like housing discrimination. And so there's ways to get it in, and generally you're not going to get any flack for bringing it in. It's a matter of time, knowledge, and opportunity, and those kind of active efforts like the Teaching American History grants were ways to facilitate that. And we tried to do that in Rochester, but when those grants ended, those opportunities dried up somewhat, although there's a lot of people still trying to make sure that they inject their teaching with some local relevance that will bring that history alive for our students.
And Stefan, before I turn it over to Shane to respond to some of your comments, what's one kind of change that could be made in the structure of our teaching that would allow for a little bit more flexibility in terms of how teachers approach subjects like this?
Well, there's one of the issues that comes up is civil rights history comes at the end of the 11th grade survey course, for example, at a time when a lot of teachers are hurrying with an exam looming that the students need to pass to graduate. So allowing for more, so there's some curricular shifts there, but you can find places to inject it if you make a conscious choice to do it. I think it's more getting teachers together to collaborate on ways to create the kinds of lessons and units that could include this information. It's almost more of a providing those professional learning opportunities. It's not so much because you can find spaces in the curriculum for this if you're determined to do so. But of course, there's a lot of things competing for your attention. So I guess professional learning that emphasizes this, that encourages teachers to include this kind of material in what they do with students.
Stefan, thank you so much for the phone call. What do you think, Shane?
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Stefan's saying, and I definitely think that it'd be great to have more administrative encouragement and professional development for teaching civil rights, especially local civil rights movements, and more resources for this kind of thing. I think it'd also be great if New York State included it in the social studies standards as something that needed to be taught, because right now it's not in the standards. It's more something that you can bring out from what's in the standards.
Yeah, right. I mean, exactly what Stefan is saying and what you're saying is, you know, you look for these opportunities to work in lessons like this, Great Migration. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking about the Teaching American History grant for the RCSD. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is if it's part of the standards, then it's going to be taught, right?
I mean, Definitely.
And that would be, but what would it require to make it part of the standards? Who's the gatekeeper there? Who makes the decision there?
Oh man, that's a big one. I guess
I don't know the
Board of Regents.
Okay.
I wouldn't know specifically. Yeah.
Okay, so that goes way high up the ladder, over your and my pay grade. It's not that it's impossible, but it would require a standard change there, and so that's worth exploring on a different day. Who sets the standards, and how would those potentially change? I'm late for our only break. Eric, Cindy, Bonnie, all waiting to jump into the conversation with Shane Wiegand, who is a fourth grade teacher at File Elementary School in the Rush Henrietta School District. We're talking about teaching discrimination, teaching housing discrimination, teaching redlining in our schools. That most schools, from what I can gather, my own school experience outside Cleveland growing up, do not teach, or at least don't teach in any detail. He's a fourth grade teacher and decided his students need to start understanding as much as they can about the subject. So let's go ahead and get our only break of the hour and come right back and keep the conversation going. Coming up in our second hour, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, Star Wars made an anti-white film. Do you believe that? White supremacists feel like the new Star Wars film is anti-white because most of the villains are white males and the heroes are heroes of color or a white female. It's true. There's a controversy. We'll talk about Star Wars next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before I get back to your phone calls, a number of listeners have asked about reading materials. And Shane, what would be your short reading list for anyone who wants to better understand redlining, for example? What would you have them read?
I'd first of all recommend the Ta-Nehisi Coates article, Case for Reparations, but also Nicole Hannah-Jones' article, Living Apart, that she did with ProPublica. That's by far my favorite.
Say the name again and the name of the article again.
Her name is Nicole Hannah-Jones. The article is called Living Apart, and it's at ProPublica. She writes for New York Magazine now and has done a lot with education and segregation. Mm-hmm. I'd also recommend the This American Life story on the Fair Housing Act. That's an awesome story as well. And Nicole Hannah-Jones is on there. So if you don't want to read something, you'd rather listen to the story, it's right there as well. I recommend those two the most.
All right. So those are good places to start there. Eric in Rochester, next up on the phone. Go ahead, Eric.
Hi, Evan. This is Eric Kane. And I'm calling because this topic is really important today, and it's as it relates broadly to health and education. There are lots of data now that suggests that people – their destiny on the day they're born, obviously there are individual differences, may be highly related to the zip code in which they live. And so redlining is not only a question of the past, but it's potentially an issue for the future. Health is highly related to zip code. And so we can't turn away from this as this simply a lesson long-lived but easily forgotten.
Yeah, Eric, by the way, Eric is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And so any thoughts on, sort of what we do about this, Eric? I mean, or is this more of at least understanding, as Shane has said, understanding what got us here to give us a better chance to make decisions going forward?
Well, I think one of the questions is, are the forces that were underlining in red exclusions gone, or are they still present? And if they're still present, what do we do about them? And I think there's lots of evidence that there are ways that people are excluded from opportunity. We're not saying that people should be given a sort of a free hand, but rather an open door. And this was a way in which the doors were closed, and doors are often still closed. I mean, if we look at the educational opportunities in our suburbs versus the city, it certainly speaks to that. Clearly, in terms of things like health, we have to have health programs that reach across, some people can pay for really great health in this country, and other people have a really hard time paying for great health. We have the best health opportunities in the world, but we certainly don't have the best health care in the world because there's so many people who are excluded. So we can't let zip code be a determinant for future life. But those are my thoughts, and obviously other people may have different opinions.
As always. Eric, thank you so much for calling the program and weighing in. It's nice to hear from you. It's Eric Kane, from the chair of the Department of Psychiatry from the University of Rochester. And Shane Wiegand, he's right. Your zip code at birth has a lot to say about what's likely to happen. It doesn't mean, again, that you can't change that, but it does have a lot to say about that. And, you know, you teach some students, as you say, who moved to your district, Rush Henrietta, from the city of Rochester. Does this shake them up? Or do some students show some empathy more? Do you see any development of at least, you know, any reason to think, well, they're better understanding this, or they're going to show more empathy? You know, how do you, I don't know how you measure that, but are you seeing that in some students in any ways?
I definitely see empathy, but one thing that's great about my school, File Elementary, is how diverse it is. In my class, I think half of my class is white, and the rest are students of color from a variety of different countries, and some who are African American and Latino. And I think because of that culture, and my school is definitely a very integrated school, and they grow up around people who are different than them. So from kindergarten, they're kind of taught that people look different, people speak different languages, they do different things, and I think that there's already sort of an acceptance built in. So I don't get any defensiveness from the students in my class that I don't know would be had somewhere else.
Okay. And before I jump back to your phone calls, Eric mentioned the difference in health outcomes based on where you're born. And that's true. And we're going to see in the next presidential administration some significant changes to health care. We're not exactly sure what a new or, you know, sort of replacement system for the Affordable Care Act will bring. We'll have to see. We're also going to see a new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and that's Dr. Ben Carson. And look, I don't know how much you want to or can say publicly about this, Shane, but I'm curious to know, given the fact that you're teaching fourth graders, about redlining, about housing discrimination, how do you feel about, or any concerns you may have, or optimism you may have about Dr. Ben Carson in that role?
I think he said, if I can recall correctly, he said some things that are similar to what President Nixon said, that he doesn't think it's right for the federal government to enforce government-enforced integration, I think is a term he's, I don't know if I'm completely right, but something along those lines that has been said in both parts. But to me, that'd be breaking, that goes against what the 1968 Civil Rights Law says, the Fair Housing Act, that the government is tasked with affirmatively furthering fair housing. And so to me, it's not forced integration, it's correcting a problem that the federal government and local communities like ours had already created.
Okay. Back to the phones, and this is Cindy in Rochester. Go ahead, Cindy.
Oh, hi. I want to thank the young man who's, the teacher that is, who is talking about this subject with students, despite the larger response pattern to be, we can't talk about that because that makes us somebody in the press and somebody subjugated by that practices. But there was a sociologist a long time ago who called this kind of stuff redlining and all of those things, described it as opportunity hoarding. And when we hoard opportunities, it means we keep people out of spaces that are supposed to be available to everyone. You began this show, Evan, by talking about a horrible example of how a black man who had a family and bought a house and didn't have, and it was preying, P-R-E-Y, on those people. And we seek to belong. And when persons like the teacher there today engage in practices that are not condoned by the state-mandated curriculum and all of that kind of stuff, we run the risk of being seen as radical outsiders and that kind of thing. So I'd like to know, What is the demographic of that class, of that school? Do you think that the teachers who are black could do the same things that he's doing in their classroom? Do you think the white teachers are doing, avoiding those things because it's even for him, it's kind of uncomfortable and he has to be very, very careful? And when you teach about taboo subjects like race and gender discrimination and those kinds of things, you really run the risk of being seen as an outsider, as someone who is not a good citizen. And social change doesn't come from, as Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass taught us, from saying, I wish it would happen. One has to fuel change. You have to make it happen.
Yeah, and Cindy, can I just bring up one follow-up for you, and then I'll let Shane answer some more here?
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I've got some numbers for you, not from Shane's school directly, but in the Rush Henrietta School District. Interestingly enough, Rush Henrietta has the highest proportion of black teachers in the district outside the city of Rochester in Monroe County, and I think it's 1.5%, whereas the students in Henrietta mm-hmm. are, and I'm just kind of doing a quick calculation on numbers, it's in the range of 14 to 16%, so something along those lines. So every school district, students of color are woefully underrepresented with teachers of color in terms of there's just not parity. White students are overrepresented on teaching staffs. We know that. And so in Rush Henrietta, the whole district of Rush Henrietta has 11 African-American teachers, 4 Latino teachers, 6 Asian teachers, no Native American teachers, 550 white teachers. So those are the numbers out of, let's see here, 571 teachers, 550 are white in Rush Henrietta. But I wanted to ask you a quick follow-up to that, which is this. You know, I don't want to misstep here, but I'm going to respond to some of what I've heard from friends of color, listeners of color, community leaders of color. Essentially, the message is occasionally it is unfair for the African-American community leaders or a teacher in different positions to have to be the one to take up an issue. In other words, because then it looks like, well, that's a black issue, as opposed to that's an American issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Shane as a white teacher, I think, is representative of teachers who are not willing to say, well, when black teachers teach it, maybe we'll listen, or when teachers of color teach it, maybe we'll listen, as opposed to saying this is an American issue. But Cindy, do you agree with that, that there has to be, you know, support from, because most of the teachers are white, there's not very many teachers of color. There has to be support from white teachers like Shane to mm-hmm. sort of normalize teaching these kind of subjects.
Well, he has the power to do that.
Right, right.
Individual power, I mean. Black teachers are probably much more careful about broaching these subjects, even though they know it's in our lives every day. We live it. Redlining, to say, oh, I hadn't learned about it, I didn't know about redlining. I knew about redlining as a little kid. Mm-hmm. I knew about it from the time I could think. After I learned my ABCs, I knew about it even before then, but I couldn't name it. But yes, I think we need everybody to agree that social change comes from practicing it, from doing it, not from just talking about it. You've got to be the change that you want in the world, as Gandhi used to say. And we have to live that by making what we do reflective of what our practice is. And not hiring black teachers in these surrounding school districts, and sometimes even in Rochester, is indicative of the fact that these spaces, these publicly supported spaces, are off limit to most of us who are not majority population members. We are relegated to what it is to the good wishes and kind of favoritism. I'm doing you a favor kind of practice mm-hmm. for those of us who are not. I'm not white, let's put it bluntly.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, schools are, of course, intended to help people feel patriotic about their country, to feel wonderful about being American citizens and that kind of thing. But they also should be spaces where we can offer the hope of growing. And I think that the major mistake we made during the Civil Rights Movement is that we focused almost exclusively on getting our kids into integrated schools. And we didn't fight for housing. Housing is the number one issue in our lives, daily lives, every day. And if we have good housing, the children that we raise and give birth to, that kind of thing, will feel like I have an opportunity. I live in a good community, I'm safe, because safety is an important thing. But we thought, and I don't blame us for doing that, I'm observing it. Just like if I see out today, it's overcast. I'm just telling you what
Absolutely.
Happened.
Yes.
And it's awful that we had to make that choice. But I think we can rectify that a little bit by now focusing a lot more on the impact of inadequate housing and inadequate access, again, opportunity hoarding, to the kind of living spaces that will enhance our lives, that makes us feel like we are not subject to the kind of structural limitations. Well, we are subject to them, but that we are working to transform the structural limitations in our society.
Cindy, thank you so much for the phone call. It's wonderful to hear from you. I appreciate that. Shane, go ahead. She gave you a lot to think about there. But go ahead.
A lot of really great stuff. Thanks so much for that. I think she really got right down to it. We've kind of avoided a root cause, which is housing. In trying to integrate schools, people who are white, they fled to the suburbs, and they're faced with zoning laws and prices of housing and a lack of, like Ed Doherty's talked about, there's a huge lack of affordable housing in all of our suburbs here in Rochester. And so there hasn't been an easy way for people to move to suburban communities and to be a part of those schools. And therefore, we see some very predominantly white schools in the suburbs and predominantly black schools in the city. And I think what's so interesting to me about this topic is when I look at poverty in the city and when I look at all these problems in the city, and I live in the Beechwood neighborhood in the city and I see these problems every day, and I also see so much hope and love and great community every day, I think that we, in being so segregated, we're segregated because of housing. We have to look at these root issues. And I think housing is one of the primary root issues that's been definitely overlooked.
I think Cindy asking about the demographics of teachers and students is an interesting question. And Megan Mack, producer, corrected me just to make sure I'm right on the numbers. It's 1.9% African-American teachers in the Henrietta District, not 1.5. So it's 1.9%. Still fewer than 2% in Henrietta. And that's the biggest number by percentage of any suburban district in the entire county. But I guess back to that point there, Shane, this can't just be a subject of, well, redlining, for example. Mm-hmm. We can't just say, well, black teachers will teach that. Because number one, there's not a lot of African-American teachers. But number two, that's not just an issue for the African-American community. This is all of us, right?
Yeah.
And if we waited for that, we may be waiting forever. So I think what Cindy and others are saying is they see you making a change, you making a decision, even though it's not in the standards, and even though you're a white teacher. You're doing it because you feel like you should or you have to. But how do you feel about the importance of white community leaders, white teachers, making decisions to say, we're not going to wait for someone from a community of color to step up?
I think that's a big part of why I wanted to be on the show today, is that I think that people who are white really need to step up and use the white privilege that they have to talk about these issues and to take the time to read a couple articles and learn about this basic history of segregation and housing issues here in Rochester today. And I think that's something that we really don't talk about enough. And yeah.
And here's an email from Mike, who is with a local realty company. He just says, listening to your show right now, and this gap in fair housing awareness is significant enough that it was only a few years back, 2008, that real estate agents were required to start taking a minimum number of hours of fair housing education in order to renew their licenses every 2 years. Prior to that, fair housing was a small part of pre-licensing classes, and hopefully the ongoing requirement will help elevate awareness in agents, and they have an opportunity and a responsibility to then educate the public. More education on the subject is always beneficial. That's from Mike. Thank you, Mike. I did not know that. I certainly appreciate hearing that. Let me go back to the phones. Elliot in Rochester next. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yeah, I find the conversation very, very important. And I'm just wondering if the teacher goes into the history, there's a whole history of deed covenants throughout the country, directing attention to those practices in American real estate of how property should be used or sold, and even dating from the 20s and 30s in some states, like in Vermont, you couldn't sell a house to Jews, or in Arizona, you couldn't sell it to people of color, only restricted to any person who, you couldn't sell to a house to anybody who is not of the white or Caucasian race. So that the whole history, and even in our own town of Brighton, I have friends of mine who bought houses in the, I don't want to say the neighborhood to prejudice it, but looking at the deeds of the 40s and 50s, there were definite restrictions that you couldn't sell houses to Jews. So I'm saying, in terms of the whole issue of discrimination in housing, it reaches, it goes way back in the whole history of American real estate. That is quite, I think, important for kids to understand that these restrictive covenants are illegal, but have occurred.
Elliot, thanks for the phone call. Shane?
Yeah, we definitely talk about in Brighton how they used to have the racial covenants that restricted African Americans from living in Brighton. And then we talk about how in other suburbs it wasn't quite as blatant, but it achieved the same gain. And when we look at the population and census numbers today, you kind of see that the result of those practices. And we mention it. We don't go too deep into it, though.
Stephanie in Pittsford sends an email and says, I do think children should be taught about redlining and other issues related to social and racial justice. Civil rights is about more than heroes and holidays. I especially like how the teacher relates it to local history. The one caution I would make to any teacher taking on these issues, and especially white teachers, is to be aware that students may respond to the lessons in different ways and have different needs. This was brought home powerfully to me when my son was in third grade and was being taught about school desegregation. As the only boy of color in his almost entirely white class and majority white school, where he had no teachers of color, the unit made him scared that his teachers would become like the, quote, mean white people in the story they were reading of Ruby Bridges, who was one of the first children to integrate New Orleans schools. His reactions were unexpected by the teachers, but parents of color whom I shared the story with all completely understood. It was easy for the white teacher and students to interpret the story as one of how strong Ruby Bridges was, how brave, etc. But for a child who identifies with the person who is targeted, the lesson can easily be about how dangerous the world can be for them. Shane, what do you think?
It's heartbreaking to hear that. And I guess I definitely imagine that that happens, especially when there's only one student of color in a class and no teachers of color. It's a little bit different in my classroom because of the diversity at the school. But one thing I do whenever I talk about these issues or about the civil rights movement or when I've taught Ruby Bridges is I talk about the activism I participate in here in Rochester, and I talk about my neighborhood, and I talk about the different things that I'm doing, because I want kids to know that I'm a partner in it and that we as a class, we're a community that stands up against. Like, one thing we always talk about is how we stand up together against bullying, and that this is a form of kind of like bullying, to put it in kids' terms, and that we're together in this and that we're a team on this kind of stuff and we're learning about it together, so that the culture of the classroom is already one that fosters and encourages diversity and is also one that encourages, like, we stand together against these kinds of issues.
Chris on Twitter says, we will be sure that our son learns it at a much earlier age. If not at school, then we will discuss this at home. That's from Chris.
Great.
And back to the phones and Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes. I wasn't brought up in the Rochester area. I come from the New York City area, Brooklyn in particular, brought up in the 50s and 60s. And I've got to tell you that, as far as I'm concerned, it was common knowledge that redlining existed. You didn't hear about it too much in formal classes, but certainly it was in the newspapers, the New York Times, the Daily News, the New York Post. These articles appeared pretty much not every single week, but certainly from time to time you would see articles about redlining, about the insurance companies and the real estate companies lining out areas that would not be allowed to be, or discouraged Black people or Hispanic people from living there. Perhaps Rochester is different, but there are certainly other areas of the country that, even though it was common knowledge, the fact that it existed is certainly wrong. And fortunately, in most places, it's clearly illegal. Perhaps the legalities are not enforced sufficiently, but I'm a little surprised that in this area that at least the knowledge that it existed is not as well known to people as your callers seem to indicate.
Yeah, Paul, thank you for the phone call. I would just say I reached out just to kind of do a little online sampling. I heard from people in California, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, Manhattan, that's part of New York, but a different part of New York, this morning, and routinely heard from everyone everywhere, Toronto, Canada, that either wasn't taught in my school at all, and I heard from a number of people saying, I've never even heard of the term redlining, let alone understood the concept. So I would just say, Paul, I think it's great that your experience is that it was more commonly understood, but I don't think it's very commonly understood in this country, and I'm trying not to take sort of a myopic view of it here. What do you think, Shane?
Yeah, I think it's great that you knew about it, yeah. And I know there's definitely been some, like, coverage of it. I know in Atlanta they did a big Pulitzer Prize winning series on it and in a few places in the 80s. And like it's been talked about, especially in Chicago. But because it's been absent from curriculum and because it's something that kind of we've seen, like the Fair Housing Act happened in 68 and that kind of got solved and there was a few, places where redlining reared its ugly head since then. there still hasn't been a whole lot of conversation about the lack of enforcement or how the federal government has made it very individuals-based and put the responsibility for fighting redlining and segregated housing on the individual, someone who's already potentially been disenfranchised.
And the more time that passes, the more I think the concern is that the following generations will either think, well, not my problem, it doesn't happen anymore, or not be taught it at all. And I think what we're seeing is it's often not taught at all. About 30 seconds, some final thoughts from you about what the importance of this issue and your view as a teacher on this, Shane?
I think my final thoughts would just be that this is a huge issue, segregation and redlining, and something that I think we should all know about. We need to talk about the root causes. I think in Rochester we do a lot of charity work and relief work, but I think if we really want to solve these problems of racism, segregation, and poverty in Rochester, we really need to look into the root cause, which I think is in many ways segregation having to do with housing.
Well, Shane Wiegand is a fourth grade teacher in the Rush Henrietta School District, and as you heard, teaching housing discrimination, teaching redlining and related subjects is not a requirement for him. It's not part of the standards. But he does it, and we're not hearing too many schools that do. And that's not to demean schools. I mean, everyone's busy. Shane, you want to jump in real quick here?
And would it be possible to share the brief curriculum thing that I used with online somewhere for people to access?
Yeah. In fact, we can probably attach it to the podcast page. Is that something that you can do?
That would be awesome.
All right, let's do that. So if you jump on WXXINews.org/connections, when our podcast posts this afternoon, we will attach that there. You can check it out there. Thank you for starting this conversation with us by reaching out here and keeping it going in the community. It's been great talking to you, Shane.
Thank you so much, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections next.